Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle, LAPD Chief. Michael Moore joins us for our regularly scheduled conversation, not just about his department, but general topics in law enforcement. We begin with one of those, and that's predictive policing. LAPD, a pioneer in using technology to try and determine where crimes of a particular type are most likely to occur, how to deploy personnel to deal with that. Other departments also using predictive policing in recent years to try and help with their deployment. But you might have seen an LA Times article from earlier this month said a number of the departments are now rethinking how helpful the technology is. Chief Moore, good to have you with us. We appreciate it very much.
Good morning, Larry. Great to be here.
And I wonder about your thoughts about the technology. Are these software programs helpful in deploying officers?
I think they're tools, and those tools continue to evolve, just as we've seen analytics evolve over time for all types of businesses and human activity. Let's be clear. Policing needs to be informed, and we need to put resources where we believe they're going to have the greatest impact on community safety. Predictive behavior of suspects, of individuals who go out and offend, is a proven fact. It's not a matter of question. If we think about traffic patterns, if we think about just how we go about our daily routine, there's patterns, there's habits, and criminals have similar types of behaviors. We've seen through the National Academy of Sciences, their research, that behaviors relating to locations, offenders like to look at a particular neighborhood. Once they see success there, begin focusing their energies, and it kind of grows, and that you see a hot spot. That type of policing has been in existence for more than 20 years. Data systems and analytics today allow us to move that from just a crime analyst looking at a heat map to actually using machine logic to understand with a greater eye and actually removing biases that an individual might have to say, predictively, here's where the best use of having a presence of officers may help you displace or stop an individual from offending because they see a cop or see an officer where previously an officer may not be.
When you or members of your command staff attend conferences on law enforcement, is this a hot topic of debate as to whether these predictive software systems bear fruit?
Yeah, yes, because two aspects of this. First of all, there's an actual program or algorithm that's been trademarked as predictive policing. And we, as a department, are been using that algorithm and that software for 5, 6, 7, 8 years now. And as we've used it, we believe we see an impact on underlying community safety. We've had some studies very early on that showed that result. But I'm not satisfied with those studies because those studies have been called into question of how objective they were or how thorough they were. And so we're going to go back and look at the use of that particular program with some outside universities, people who have nothing to do with the origins of this predictive policing algorithm, and to see if it can demonstrate that program itself is having a measurable impact. But as the author said in that article that came up with this predictive policing algorithm, if we had said that program was responsible for that crime reduction, he would have been dismissive of that because it's not the what drives crime and what influences crime. It has so many different factors. But I will say this, in a department of our limited size in a city so large that I need information, I need data points to understand where is crime occurring, how is it occurring, what is the nature of the location, the time and place, also the nature of the offender, to help inform officers as they go about their day to figure out where is their best use of their time, where is the best use of their work. And then lastly, and with concerns about from privacy advocates and others about the fairness of this, we began publishing our maps recently to show the community in their neighborhood where this program is identifying emerging issues of property crime. And I believe that transparency, showing our work, if you will, I'm hopeful that not just will they understand how this program is actually used, but also take advantage of that and say, why is my neighborhood popping up?
Well, yeah, I was going to say, this is good. You're alerting people, whether it's neighborhood watch programs or
exactly, whatever
it is, people to look out if you see a spike in burglaries.
And this is previously, because this program looks at the last 10 years of data, There is no race involved. This is entirely just location-based. But they can ask themselves, what is it about my neighborhood that now I'm popping up on a suspicious list or a list that says the likelihood of crime occurring in my area is increased? And can work with the police. They can work with their neighbors. They can understand so that what they can do to harden the target, to improve prevention, which at the end lowers crime.
Now, speaking of predictions of crime, the Inspector General Mark Smith had written a memo to the police commission raising concerns about a program which identified individuals most likely to reoffend. And the department is scrapping that. Is that correct?
We did. I suspended that last August when I found concerns were identified that we could not satisfy, that offenders, chronic offenders, that was the term, had been applied on an uneven basis. What is a chronic offender? This is the theory behind a program called LASER, another data-driven analytics, was that a small percentage of those involved in crime commit the majority of crime. And we've seen that whether we call them a chronic offender, a habitual criminal, a career criminal. And that program, that piloted effort, said those chronic offenders were the individuals most likely responsible for the concentration of violence in these corridors or zones. And that by working those zones with a presence of officers and a problem-solving effort of how to pull apart the violence that keeps concentrated in those neighborhoods disproportionately, and at the same time being mindful that these chronic offenders we believe are contributing to that we could lower violent crime. Now, what we found over the course of using and experimenting with that program, if you will, is that those chronic offenders weren't frequently arrested. That those chronic offenders we didn't prove were actually involved in future crimes within those areas. And because of the concerns about the unevenness of how it was applied, the lack of information about just how those individuals were identified, I said, this is not helping us. This is not building trust. And so we scrapped the program. We no longer use the LASER program. We still are very much focused on hotspots, on concentrations where an over-concentration of violent crime occurs, but we're no longer going to look to that program to identify those chronic offenders. I don't think, by the way, I don't think any of those chronic offenders that were identified, their rights were violated. I do not believe that. I don't. Those that being present on that list, if you will, did not in and of itself constitute reasonable suspicion or probable cause for an officer to take action.
Was one of the problems with having it be accurate is who's most likely to reoffend, the inputs into the software? I mean, so you're looking for proxies, right, of potential, you know, markers for people reoffending. So maybe it's, you say, well, if someone's living with family members, that reduces the chance of reoffending. If they're not associating with past, you know, gang members, then maybe they're less like. I mean, were they not using good filters?
So the filters evolved over time. And for instance, initially, one of the filters was that if an officer stopped an individual and conducted what's called a field interview, that was worth a point. If an individual was identified as a gang member, that was worth a point. If a person was arrested for a gun-related violent crime, that was worth 5 points. And you tallied those points up and then prioritized for the top 10 or 12 individuals in an area. And recency of arrests, on probation or parole, those are all points. What I found over time was that we had individuals that their point totals were particularly low, which was caused me concerns, and made up of acts of like of an FI or an interview in the street, which in and of itself is not a crime. And so at the end of the day, we said this program is not helping us and it's undermining the faith and confidence of the community in us. Let's go back to our more traditional standards. And our more traditional standards is to look at those people who are on parole or probation for convictions for violent crimes and other offenses. And where are they at now and what are they doing? To look at actual descriptions of suspects and those suspects, those descriptions, how do they overlay into those people on probation and parole? and also reach out, of course, work with the community to identify who are those people responsible for those violent crimes. And once those are identified, go out, find them, and bring them to justice.
We're talking with Michael Moore, LAPD chief. One of the other pieces of technology we're going to look at is the drone program. You've had a limited time test of drones to see how they could be used. Civil liberties advocates have concerns that drones could be used for surveillance or even could have weapons included in the drones, which would pose a public safety threat in their view. What's your perception of how this program has worked?
This is the evolution of technology. We have used robots on the ground, if you will, machines, to in place of putting an officer in harm's way, to go into a barricaded suspect's house to determine where he or she was at, and to help give situational awareness and not to have to put an officer in that scenario. That has provided for – that saved officers' lives and allowed us also to de-escalate situations where that robot inside of a house, I've seen as an incident commander, the suspect inside determined it's time to give up. We've communicated through that with a microphone and with lights to say, you know, you need to give up. You need to, you know, really put that gun down, step outside. If you don't, these are the consequences. These are the next steps. And those – that medium has been effective and has allowed us not to have to put officers in that conversation and be confronted with a person who could potentially escalate and use deadly force. Just this morning, we used the latest was the latest incident in which we used one of the small UASs, unmanned aerial systems, a drone. We had a group of gang members who and involved in a vicious attack. Were known to carry high-power weapons and in possession of firearms to resist the police. And with a search warrant and an order by the court, when we arrived at the location with our special weapons and tactics because of the nature of the threat that they posed, the location was fortified and had barriers and cameras that even the officers approaching it would potentially expose those officers to a deadly assault. And so a decision was made on scene. Initially, we were going to use an airship to surveil it, to understand where those suspects were at, a helicopter. Yeah. But because of the weather in the San Pedro area, the fog bank came down and we didn't have access to that. So the on-scene commander, with the oversight and approval of the staff officer, this is one of the most senior members of the organization, approved the utilization of that drone. What that drone allowed us to do was to have a situational awareness that did not expose officers unnecessarily to a deadly threat. And when the suspects inside refused to come out, acknowledging the police and still refused to come out, and we had to resort to using tear gas, one of the individuals, which was previously known to be a runner, that would be suspected of fleeing, fled and tried to break that perimeter. That UAS, that drone in the air, captured that movement and was able to allow and communicate that to ground commanders so that that suspect was not allowed to escape into the
community. So like a helicopter would, essentially. You couldn't use the helicopter. This served in lieu of that.
And I understand privacy concerns, as there are privacy concerns with the use of our helicopters. There's privacy concerns in regards to all types of technology. And we're mindful of that, and we're going to protect those privacy concerns. And at the same time, balance that with the safety of our communities and safety of our personnel.
Of course, the concerns that civil liberties activists have is that a helicopter is pretty easy to see. They're noisy. They're large enough. The drones might not be visible, and people might not know that they're being watched by the drone.
That's correct. And the courts have been clear about the use of surveillance and the public use of surveillance and the privacy protections that that people enjoy. We've seen this. There's case law relative to people in their backyards growing illicit materials or having other evidence of crime and overflights, and whether or not those overflights were invasions of privacy. And this is another area that for the use of drones, we have similar protections. I believe that the amount and the path in which the commission has authored and allowed us to move is one that is measured, that has a great deal of transparency and oversight by our civilian board, and one that's going to save lives.
We'll continue our conversation with LAPD Chief Michael Moore, his regularly scheduled visit with us. We're going to talk about the ICE raids that were expected across the country beginning last Sunday. They haven't materialized in the way that were expected. We'll talk about that. as well as the joint law enforcement arrests of alleged MS-13 gang members from the San Fernando Valley. We'll be back after a live update from Hetty Lynn Hurdies. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Very good morning to you. I'm Larry Mantle with LAPD Chief Michael Moore, who joins us in studio on a regular basis on the program. The LA Times just reporting that an LAPD officer has been charged with rape following a sexual assault investigation. The Times reporting that 10-year LAPD veteran Officer William Rodriguez, most recently of Valley Traffic Division, taken into custody yesterday. He's being charged with two counts of forcible rape in a case with a special allegation of multiple victims. Chief, just take a moment on this. What can you share with us about this investigation?
Well, this is a dark hour for us. The investigation began in November of 2018 when Officer Rodriguez, while off duty, was alleged to have been involved in a sexual assault involving an acquaintance. Since we assigned our robbery, homicide, sexual assault detectives on this, they're our elite group, highly trained, specialized. And in their investigation and over the course of their investigation to the facts and circumstances of that alleged assault, they identified Officer Rodriguez's involvement in a second sexual assault that occurred back in 2015. In that instance, which happened in August of that year, Officer Rodriguez's identity was not known. In that sexual assault, however, there was a rape kit that was taken, and Officer Rodriguez was tied to that through a DNA.
And so from the recent incident.
Yes, from the investigation from the most recent incident and the allegations that sprang from there, the investigative levels and steps involved the ability to capture his DNA. And in doing that, it was flagged based on the DNA profile that was identified from 2015. In 2015, and that assault, as I understand it, Officer Rodriguez's name, his identity was not known. So this was a stranger offense in the sense of—
Where the more recent, they were acquaintances.
He was known to this individual from the allegations in November of this year. I'm proud of the work that our detectives move forward in. I'm embarrassed and I'm— It's a again, as I said, it's a dark moment for us as we see one of our own people, his actions as alleged, and will be he'll have his day in court. But you know, what we believe at this, as we sit here today, is that he tarnished the badge. He broke his oath. He attacked in these two assaults it's just unfortunate. Now, moving forward, though, I want to again congratulate and. The homicide or the robbery homicide detectives for their work in this, and also to reassure the public, we're going to take these investigations where they take us. And if that means that it includes implicating one of our own of a rank and file, then so be it. And we're not going to shy away from that. We're going to lean into it and hold the public's trust close to us.
Chief Moore, I also wanted to ask you about what were expected to be significant ICE deportation seizures of individuals starting on Sunday. Doesn't seem like we've had what was anticipated. But I was just curious about your department's knowledge of what goes on. Do you get any word of those sorts of actions before they happen? How do you find out about it if there are larger scale arrests of individuals on immigration offenses?
That is entirely dependent on ICE and their willingness to and their officials to share information with us in advance of their planned raids or their sweeps. Earlier, about a month ago, when President Trump announced that there would be, and he had varying numbers of 20,000, 10,000, 1,000 individuals that would be swept up in these raids, we, working with ICE, asked what impact there would be have here in the Los Angeles region, because Los Angeles was identified publicly as one of those targeted cities and regions. And I'm happy, you know, and I was encouraged because the senior officials here were willing to share with us the numbers and the scale so that we could also communicate with a number of communities that were significantly scared and fearful that these thousands of people within Los Angeles were going to somehow be swept up. We know that there are a number of communities here that have tens of thousands of individuals who are here in an undocumented status. They're here perhaps on a visa overstay or some other matter. Those are administrative matters. And what we see is ICE's ability to go out and take enforcement action relative to those matters within their jurisdiction is their concern. What concerns me is that when there is political or other individuals that try to rattle the saber and infer or state an enormity of an action that undermines the faith and confidence of a community that they're going to be safe, we have a role to try to right that. And so in this instance, a few weeks ago, our point was there's about 140, as we understood, potential targets. And in a county of 10 million.
And not family members. Because that was one of the big concerns was, would it just be those who have the final removal orders, or was it going to be people living with them?
Exactly. And I will say that in our communicating those numbers, I do believe that senior ICE officials were upset that we announced those numbers, not that we announced who the individuals were, not that we were critical of this other than just to say this is a scale here in Los Angeles. This most recent rumored sweeps that became up last week. We had an absence of information from ICE as to the scale or magnitude.
Is that because you shared the info before, so they didn't feel they could trust you to share the numbers again?
One could infer that. I think that the absence of that information does not help the public's confidence in government. And the information is what the information is. People who are facing final deportation orders have gone through a due process and are subject to ICE's enforcement action. That is a matter for ICE. What is a matter for me is the uncertainty in what we've seen in published accounts of people unwilling and unable to get beyond their fear, and they don't walk into communities that they have a lawful right to be in. We have people who are here on visas, for instance, that have said, I just can't go on public because I'm worried that ICE is going to somehow pick me up as well. And so I've got an obligation as a law enforcement official to put facts where facts are and reassure the public that they're safe. And if they need the police, if they need law enforcement to help protect them, I need them to be able to reach out to me and not be afraid of calling.
We're going to continue our conversation with LAPD Chief Michael Moore. We're going to talk about the ongoing relationship between the department and homeless Angelenos, particularly downtown Los Angeles and other areas where encampments have been cleaned up. We'll talk about what the LAPD's role of that is. Also, a new exhibition on the history of the LAPD. We'll talk about what's there. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Back in just 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Great to have you with us. We're talking with LAPD Chief Michael Moore. Coming up in the second hour, the controversy over LA Metro's proposed rapid busway, which would connect Pasadena with North Hollywood. Residents in Eagle Rock, some of them are concerned about what changes it would bring to Colorado Boulevard in their community. We'll also talk about the effect on Burbank and Glendale and portions of the San Fernando Valley. That's coming up next hour here on Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Ongoing concerns about homeless encampments and the conflict between business owners, residents, and those without a place to live in Southern California who live in encampments. Chief, what's the latest on LAPD's enforcement priorities? Because we all still see many of these encampments.
Well, I'm encouraged by the most recent announced increases in levels of sanitation services, of the providing of showers and the ability to for people who are living in the street and living in encampments and so forth to have resources brought to help improve the safety and sanitation of these public places. Our enforcement posture hasn't changed. Those individuals that are experiencing homelessness, that are involved in criminal activity, whether it be preying upon others within who are homeless themselves or the neighborhoods in which they reside, committing crimes, We are and will continue to identify them and bring them before the criminal justice system. We have portions of the city that the homeless encampments offer a individuals in those communities believe it offers them a shield to go out and conduct a, what would otherwise be known as an open-air drug market. And I've directed my personnel to ensure that, that's not the case, that no more would we allow an open-air drug market in Mid-Wilshire or in Northridge, and we're not going to allow it in those neighborhoods, those same neighborhoods, because they're shielded or somehow disguised as an encampment. Secondly is with this outgrowth and improvement of sanitation services and outreach workers, we're here to provide for the safety of those individuals as well as the safety and security of the communities in which these encampments and people experiencing homelessness reside. And what we're not going to do is marshal those added resources for any criminal prosecution. Instead, we're looking to continue to see those resources and outreach workers and sanitation, mental health workers, social support programming, housing options to increase exponentially, and which will allow us to take a greater and greater lesser role and a presence there. Once it becomes a norm that a sanitation worker and an outreach worker is in those communities, and it's just like anyone else, then I think it's a lesser of a need for us to have a presence there.
Now, we were just talking earlier this hour with Andy Bales, CEO of the Union Rescue Mission on Skid Row, and he was expressing concern about activists in the Skid Row area who were pushing for lower police presence in that area. And Andy's point was, we've got all kinds of drug sales that are going on. We've got women that are unsafe, men that are unsafe. We've got families. We've got and that people need protection who are living on the streets. And he was arguing against, you know, making less enforcement and less of a police presence.
I'm grateful for that support. I think the providers that are particularly in the Skid Row area have some of the best understanding of the risks and challenges of the difficulties that people experiencing homelessness throughout Los Angeles face, and the role of law enforcement and its efforts to provide for the safety of all involved. There are people within the Skid Row area that are criminally involved, and those individuals, again, don't get a pass. We're not going to give them an alibi or amnesty from a consequence of their criminal actions. However, there are many more people in those communities that are suffering as a result of the criminal actions of others, and those individuals are not going to be criminalized for simply being in a public street without a without shelter.
Andy Bales said that criminal gangs essentially control drug sales and prostitution in Skid Row. Is that your assessment?
Yes. When we are making efforts each day and making arrests and prosecutions each day for individuals engaged in that conduct. We are also working with our federal partners to launch a long-range and sophisticated operation to identify those kingpins, if you will, the people who are that are marshaling resources and trying to capitalize on the Skid Row area that don't live in the Skid Row area, but they're operating. They're bringing resources. Just last week, we had a series of operations where I was told that a particular tent was selling and distributing drugs, and narcotic officers made repeated arrests there, and each time they would make those arrests, the tent would be left because of certain requirements that we leave those shelters behind, only within hours to be replaced by a quote-unquote new soldier selling drugs again, setting shop back up. My direction has been that is an instrumentality of a crime, and that in those instances, those tents will be seized as evidence of that crime, just as the sales of scales and narcotics and the possession of those demonstrate that this person is using that location to sell narcotics.
Speaking of gangs, there were a number of arrests made a couple days ago in San Fernando Valley. Alleged MS-13 gang members allegedly engaged in heinous crimes, including dismembering of rivals. Is the presence of MS-13, in your view, growing in the city of Los Angeles?
I don't believe it's growing, but first of all, each of the gangs offer different challenges, and MS historically has been one of its culture, one of the most violent gangs that we see here in Los Angeles. What we see with this indictment is a partnership with the U.S. Attorney and our federal partners that not only will the criminal actions of these individuals be held will they be held accountable in a state court, but the federal arm of prosecution will also be brought to bear. And the powers that you see there with their indictment for racketeering can have far-reaching effects, not only to the individuals that committed these heinous acts, but for those that operate in concert, those operate alongside and allowed their types of attacks facilitated, if you will. So I'm grateful for that partnership, for the L.A. County Sheriff's Department, LAPD, working with the FBI and our U.S. Attorney, Nick Hanna. Their leadership in this is going to, I think, reinforce just that the consequences for these types of this type of gang violence is going to be far-reaching and will not be satisfied with just simple arrests.
Chief, I just want to mention before we conclude, there is, of course, the LAPD Museum on York in Highland Park in the old police station there just west of Figueroa. But there's also an exhibition of mid-1900s crime photos from the department. Some of these have been on exhibit, but this is part of a brand-new exhibition that's at House of Lucy on Alameda Street in downtown Los Angeles. It's up for the next month or so. If you had a chance to look at some of this is like, you know, Chinatown or L.A. Confidential kind of stuff.
It is. And I want to thank Merrick Morton, who was also a photographer and LAPD reserve officer, who was able to gain access and really crafted a life-saving, if you will, effort of this is our history that was found in boxes in city storage that was deteriorating because of sheer age. And his intervention has now protected that for the history going forward. And for generations, they'll be able to look back and see the history of LAPD and LA City.
I've got some of my grandfather's LAPD homicide photos, one on my desk. I have to go through these, see if I see my grandfather and some of these other crime scene photos. Chief, thank you so much. Appreciate your being with us.
Thank
LAPD
you.
Chief Michael Moore with us. Much more to come in the second hour of Air Talk.